take time to do the PI, to do the presentation. Sorry. Can you get my letter back there? I'm told it's working. Introduce ourselves. I thought we knew one another here.
Thank you, Honorable Butcher. My name is Mkhululi Mlotha. I'm the Chief Director in Automotives at the DTI.
I'm from PNG.
Marco Smith from the German Consulate General.
Can you come up again? We didn't hear you.
Marco Smith from the German Consulate General.
Linda Innes, for business day. Sorry about that.
My name is Sitabise Lotlhake. I'm the one of the committee support staff.
Good morning, I'm Venetia Williams, support staff.
Morning, I'm Sibongile Kgosana, support staff.
Good morning, my name is Elsa Kutoka. I'm the web secretary. Thank you.
Good morning, I'm Nodi Sandelegane. I'm the researcher for the committee. Thank you.
No, thank you very much. Can you then allow the Chief Director to give us a presentation? Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Sir. The presentation will touch the structure of the auto industry in South Africa, the economic contribution thereof, and will also touch on the government support that supported this industry, touching on the MIDP and the APDP, and also looking at the performance of the industry under those programs. Firstly, looking at the structure, the automotive industry is generally divided into two major areas, or three. The first one is the OEMs, or vehicle assemblers. The second one is automotive component suppliers, or manufacturers. And the third one is the retail side, from your garages to the service centers. But here we're looking at, in the main, the OEMs or the vehicle assemblers. You would see from the slide that in South Africa we have seven major vehicle assemblers, and those are light motor vehicle assemblers in the main. We also have a number of those assemblers that make trucks and buses. But in the main, the light motor vehicle assemblers are in three areas. You have a cluster in Gauteng with Ford, Nissan, and BMW. You have a cluster in the Eastern Cape with VW, General Motors, and Mercedes in East London, and a Toyota in KwaZulu-Natal. However, on the retail side, you have a number of vehicle assemblers that distribute, that import and distribute vehicles in South Africa, from your Kias to your Tatas and Mahindras. On the component side, you have a number of first-tier suppliers, those that supply directly to the OEMs or vehicle assemblers, at least 120 of those. Many of them are multinationals, which means there are only a few that are South African-owned. And you have a number of your second and third tier suppliers, and most of those smaller suppliers and general engineering companies, you find a lot of local ownership in there. In terms of employment, on the vehicle assembly level, you will have currently about 80,000 people employed, whereas in the component supply industry, you have about just over 80,000. Now, the automotive... Thank you, sir. On the manufacturing side of the automotive industry, you primarily have the vehicle assemblers or vehicle manufacturers, those that put together a complete vehicle, the likes of VW, BMW, and the such. And you also have suppliers, those that make different components that they then supply to the vehicle assemblers. On the vehicle assembly side, you have seven major light motor vehicle manufacturers. Those that are situated mainly in Gauteng, the Eastern Cape, and KwaZulu-Natal. The suppliers are spread right through the country, but also the closer to the OEMs for logistical purposes. So they have to be close to the vehicle assembly plants. You have hundreds of those component suppliers. Those that supply directly to the vehicle assemblers, what we call the first-tier suppliers, there are at least 120 of them, and most of those are foreign-owned suppliers or companies. If we can look at the economic contribution of the South African automotive industry, the graph indicates that from a level of 5.5% in 1999, it's been generally hovering around 7%. In the last year, the entire industry contributed almost 7.2% to the GDP. That takes into account the entirety of the automotive industry, including the retail side. The approximately 566,000 units were produced in South Africa last year, with projections of an increase to about 627,000 this current year. However, with those numbers that might seem huge, South Africa is responsible for only 0.63% of the global production. Last year, about almost 90 million vehicles were produced globally, but for South Africa, we produced just over 500,000. In terms of exports, that have shown significant growth since 1995. Last year, we exported about 115 billion rands worth of vehicles and components. However, whilst we might be small in terms of the global market, the plants that we have here produce quality vehicles. And the likes of Mercedes-Benz of South Africa, situated in East London, has been receiving quality awards in foreign markets such as the USA for the past few years, actually. What are our major exports in this industry? On the complete built-up vehicles, we export your Nissans, VWs, BMWs, Mercedes-Benz C-Class, the Corolla and the Hilux, to a number of destinations or countries, including US, Europe, Japan, and the like. In terms of components, still our leading export components remain catalytic converters, followed by engines and parts thereof, by tires as well, and a number of other products such as stitched leather interiors, radiators, and wheels. So we export to all the major parts of the world. Now, how do we manage to do that from the tip of Africa? Whilst we might be situated at the tip of the continent, we are supported by a trade environment that allows our products to reach those markets. Firstly, we export a lot of components to the region and vehicles to the region in sub-Saharan Africa. However, also we export to the likes of the U.S. thanks to AGOA, amongst other things. Also, our trade arrangement with the EU allows us access to those markets. So in the trade environment, we have quite a supportive environment that allows us to export our products, both completely built-up vehicles as well as components to the region. And with the few other trade arrangements being considered currently, we see more opportunities in that regard. Whilst we produce about 566,000 units, however, our vehicle park is quite significant, meaning there are a lot of vehicles on our roads currently. That has been growing from about 8.7 million vehicles to just over 10 million vehicles on our roads currently. And those vehicles that are on our roads still need components to maintain and service them, and therefore there is an opportunity still for some local manufacturing of components, especially for the aftermarket, that is those that supply service parts. However, you would also realize that some of these vehicles that are on our roads are imports, and in that way it means therefore we still have to import a lot of replacement parts and service parts from abroad. The next slide just indicates government support to this industry over time. Whilst we started manufacturing or assembling vehicles in South Africa in the early 1924, government has been actively supporting this industry over time, starting with the Phase 1 in 1961, the significant sector-specific program, the local content programs of the time. And we continue along that trajectory, leading to the MIDP that was introduced in 1995, September, and the current APDP. The nature of the support has been changing over time, because then the industry was solely focusing on the domestic markets, but with the introduction of the MIDP in 95, we wanted to be fully integrated into the global market. Hence, then we saw a growth of exports, and also we reduced the protection significantly from those high levels before 95. So government has been active in supporting this industry. Hence, we still, whilst we might be far from the major markets, we still have an automotive industry. Since the introduction of the MIDP, there's been significant progress looking at the investment by the vehicle assemblers to the export values and volumes We've seen our exports going into the major markets globally. At some stage, we had significant exports to China until they grew their own industry. And our major export components remained under the MIDP, stitched leather interiors, as well as catalytic converters. However, over time, we've seen a reduction of those commodities as we try to expand the export base. And we've seen some significant improvements in productivity. Before we introduced the MIDP, we had a number of platforms and vehicle types that were exported from South Africa from about 41, and now we have less of those platforms, which means there's a more rationalization. Hence, we have more than five platforms that have production volumes of more than 40,000 units. This slide just indicates the significant growth that we've realized in export volumes as we integrated back into the global market. And we are going to see a lot of growth in this year going forward. Now, this growth in productivity and integration into the global markets had to be accompanied by significant investments in the auto sector. We've seen investment levels growing over time, and we reached some kind of a milestone last year with 6.9 billion invested during the year 2014 alone. And since we introduced the APDP and the AIS, which is part thereof, we are continuing to see significant investments in this industry. In 2013, January, we introduced the APDP, which replaced the MIDP that we had in operation since September 1995. The APDP, similar to the MIDP, has four pillars. And the APDP, why we're mentioning it separately, is the major sector-specific kind of intervention in this industry. Yes, there are other supporting mechanisms beyond this. For instance, the fact that we're limiting or almost banning the importation of used vehicles also supports this industry. But let's look at the APDP. The key four elements are the tariffs. Under the MIDP, we had tariffs gradually reducing to the levels that they were in 2012. Under the APDP, we're seeing the tariffs held steady at those levels. That's 25% for built-up vehicles and 20% for those components that are imported to assemble the vehicles. And this is primarily looking at light motor vehicles. For medium and heavy vehicles, we kept the duties at 20% as they were under the MIDP. The second element is what's under the MIDP was the duty-free allowance. And now we're talking about a vehicle assembly allowance, which is on the understanding that because of our size and therefore economies of scale, we are not going to be able to produce all the componentry that is required to produce vehicles in South Africa because of the share of the number of the volumes that we're producing of these vehicles. And therefore, the vehicle assemblers manage to get a benefit which allows them to rebate some of the duties that they incur. The VAA started at 20% in 2013. It will reduce to 18% in over 3 years. And under the APDP, we put in a new condition, which was to say, in our quest to produce higher volumes and afford the suppliers better economies of scale, we will only allow participation of those plants that manufacture a minimum of 50,000 units per annum. The third element is the production incentive. The production incentive is also in the form of duty rebates, but you get that based on your local value addition. So the more local value add you have in your components and in your vehicles, the better benefit you get. There's a formula to calculate that, starting at 55% of local value add to 50%. However, in the changeover from the MIDP to the APDP, there were some of those components that have got high local content that were suddenly getting far less a benefit. The likes of catalytic converters, leather interiors, and similar products. For those, there's a special dispensation which allows them better incentives under the PI. The last element on the APDP is the automotive investment scheme, which is in the form of a cash grant that is afforded both vehicle assemblers and component suppliers. This support is pegged at 20% of the qualifying investment for vehicle assemblers. They can get up to 30%, whereas component suppliers start at 25%, up to 35%. The idea is to support investment in the latest technologies and machinery. We've seen a significant take-up of this support over time. The next slide talks to that kind of support that has come through the AIS. This is a cash grant, and since its introduction in 2010-11, we've seen investments of more than 25 billion rand supported by this, and with a commitment from government side of just over 6 billion rand. To date, more than 4 billion has been paid to investors. Those would be investors both for vehicle assembly and for components. And this has supported more than 11,000 new jobs. This is just new jobs. Some in the main, it was sustaining those jobs that were there because the likes of BMW, for instance, they make one model from South Africa. So if they don't manage to get to win a bid to produce that model, they might close down, but we've managed through these incentives, amongst other things, to sway them to continue manufacturing in South Africa. And that has led to 11,000 new jobs created. If we look at the also the cost of the duties, the duty loss as a result of these duty rebates that are earned by the industry. You'll see that it's been averaging around 7 billion rand, growing in 2010 and 11 to just more than 8 billion rand. In 2013, it remained there. You'll see also in this slide the PAA, which is one difference from the MIDP. Under the MIDP, the investment support was also in the form of duty rebates, which was called the productive asset allowance, whereas currently it's in the form of a cash grant in the form of the automotive investment scheme. So from this year onwards, you won't see any PAA value there. Now, besides the APDP, there are other policy measures under consideration, some already being implemented. On the electric vehicles, the minister published a roadmap for public consultation in 2013. put together an intergovernmental team with also industry stakeholders to contribute to its further development. And during this year, that should be finalized as a roadmap for South Africa, which looks primarily on two areas. One, creating an environment that will allow the operation of those EVs in South Africa. We had to make sure that the standards, there are standards created to allow those vehicles to be on our roads. The FADS has been working tirelessly with that kind of with that team to allow. Hence, we already have two mass marquees on our roads, your Nissan Leaf and the BMW i3 now on our roads. But secondly, we're also looking at supporting local production of such vehicles and their components. However, it is a challenge looking at the volumes that those kind of vehicles are selling in the domestic market. That piece of work should be finalized this year. Also, in the continent, we find a number of countries looking to build or start automotive production, the likes of Nigeria, understand Zimbabwe, amongst others, looking at setting up their own industries. Whilst they may pose a competition in the long run, but we see that in the short to medium term, those offer opportunities for the local industry as well. Hence, they are getting their components and sub-assemblies from South Africa as they are starting with the semi-knocked down operations, which means the level of manufacturing of vehicles in those countries is yet to develop. So they are getting their packages currently from outside those locations, and we are fighting for a space to supply some of those components from South Africa. On the medium and heavy commercial vehicle segment, which is your minibus, taxis, trucks and buses, we've also done a bit of work in the past few years. We have designated for local procurement buses, initially focusing on the bus bodies. We put in a requirement for 80% of that body to be made in South Africa. The idea is that gradually we'll also be designating the chassis itself, so that we can do more manufacturing in South Africa, especially where public procurement is concerned. We also extended the AIS support to medium and heavy commercial vehicles to support investment therein. And lastly, we are also at this point in time trying to finalize a review of the APDP, which we started last year. However, the idea there is not to make any significant or fundamental changes, because we only introduced it in 2013. But because it was introduced or it was announced in 2008, a lot has happened in the global economy, and therefore we had to review and make sure that it's still aligned to our overall objectives. What we have seen as a result of all the work that we've been doing in the medium and heavy commercial vehicle segment is investments by the likes of Tata, FAW in Bucha, Hyundai up in Gauteng, and a few others like BAW have started investing in the medium and heavy commercial vehicle sector. I think in the next few days, Toyota will be launching a full CKD operation in Durban, where they are making the Quantum minibus. Initially, they stopped making those minibuses here. They started a few years back as an SKD or semi-knockdown operation, where they imported already built and welded and painted monocoques for final assembly here, but now the welding and painting is happening in South Africa. What we've also realized is that we needed to have some focus on improving manufacturing competitiveness of the industry itself. And in the past year, together with the industry stakeholders and the labor, we formed what we call the Automotive Supply Chain Competitiveness Initiative, which seeks to coordinate all supplier development initiatives in the industry and also be on the lookout for areas where we can localize more and inform the strategy thereof going forward. So this is this initiative has a clear business plan because there are some interventions that are managed directly by it, but also it works through a network with domestic and international entities in trying to intervene in the automotive industry. And we are seeing a significant take-up of the support that is offered by those through the ASKIM. These would vary from adopting lean manufacturing to benchmarking, also utilizing networks internationally to ensure that we can measure ourselves against the best in the world. Now, the APDP, as we have it now, is looking at stimulating the expansion of vehicle production to 1.2 million vehicles by 2020. This was based on a peak that we reached as we did the MIDP review that led to the APDP. The realization was that whilst we had achieved higher volumes from pre-MIDP days, that there was still a gap in terms of us reaching significant economies of scale. And therefore, the idea was that we encourage the vehicle assemblers through a variety of means to produce more volumes in South Africa so that they can achieve better economies of scale, in that you will also achieve the second objective of encouraging localization and the growth of the component supply industry. So the APDP, as is with the variety of support measures, is looking to encourage the industry to achieve such ambitious targets. Yes, the global economic situation hasn't helped, in that currently we're just close to those peak volumes in terms of production. But at least we've managed to get through the West as it is. When we announced the APDP together with the AIS, we've seen positive response from the industry. We've seen the likes of Mercedes-Benz investing in at least 5 billion rand, General Motors, Ford, and everybody else, and also currently there are moves to further expand their presence in South Africa, and we think that we stand a good chance if we continue supporting the industry in a way that encourages them to see South Africa as a viable manufacturing space. Also, in terms of component supply, there are opportunities for further localization for a number of products from aluminium forgings and castings to vehicle interiors. And also we're seeing a possibility of attracting a new vehicle assembly plant in the light motor vehicle space and also in the truck and bus business. With those few slides, thank you, Honorable Chair.
Thanks very much, Chief Director. Members, can I suggest that we do the second presentation, and then after it, we go for tea break, then we deliberate with both after. Can I call you Tanya?
Chairperson, and thanks members of the Portfolio Committee for inviting us to speak on the issue. We can go to the first slide off. Thanks. So, I mean, this is background that I put in, and I know you all know this very well, but I just put it in for anyone who's reading it outside. But as you know, that the Economic Development Department was established in 2009, and we've assumed responsibilities for creating decent employment through inclusive growth, including implementing the National Development Plan, the New Growth Path, IPAP, APAP, and the National Infrastructure Plan. And you also well know that EDD's mandate includes oversight of the following legislation: the Industrial Development Corporation Act, both the IDC, the Competition Act, the International Trade Administration Act, and the Infrastructure Development Act. So in reporting to you today and on speaking on what's happening in autos, we're reporting to you on what the IDC is doing on auto in terms of funding, what IPAC is doing in terms of auto, and what the Competition Commission has been doing in terms of auto, if that's okay, honourable members. So in terms of IDC investment, over the last 5 years, the IDC's net approvals were $3.6 billion to 51 companies in the automotive sector, and this created and saved 12,660 jobs over the same time. In fact, what's not written there, but we've just, if you're interested in knowing, I know the DM said to me you might be interested in knowing, is that the jobs actually created in that period were 7,319, and the jobs actually saved through the IDC funding was 5,341 in that period. In terms of the role of ITAC, ITAC actually administers the APDP, so the DTI has spoken a lot about the measures, but ITAC's the administrative body that administers the DTI incentive scheme, and it supports the domestic manufacturers of automotive products. So the support comes mainly in the form of customs, duties, and rebates. What the DTI said, and we're just really repeating here, is a key form of support is the 25% customs duty on fully built-up vehicles, and then there's the 25% customs duty on the import of automotive components. So essentially, if you want to bring in an imported car from overseas, you're going to pay 25% customs duty, and that's really to protect companies manufacturing cars here, and we're supporting the manufacturers, the companies, and workers in South Africa. We can go to the next slide. But what ITAC administers, so it's largely just an administrative function, is the rebate credit. So what happens when ITAC administers the rebate credit? Is they worked out in terms of companies can earn the credit rebate in terms of the amount of local value addition. So if a company, and DPR will be able to give much more detail on this than I can. So DPR colleagues, I'm going to ask you to correct me where I go off track here. But if, for example, gosh, they're smiling sweetly at me, and I'm sure members of the portfolio committee can probably add where I'm going wrong. I've worked this out in my head, so I'm determined to say it, if you don't mind. Where a company, for example, like Mercedes, so the C-Class Mercedes is made here, and I know we export it all over the world. Where we add a lot of local additions, so it's lots of components made in South Africa, lots of labor made in South Africa, so there's very high local South African content is made here. What that company can do is they work out how much local content is made here. When they then import the big fancy Mercedes, they've got to keep paying that 25%. So that can run into hundreds of millions of rand. They'll get the rebate worked out by ITAC. So that's ITAC's administrative function. They'll work out how much, ITAC will work out how much. And they'll go back to ITAC and say, we want a rebate credit. Instead of paying you to SARS, how many hundreds of millions of tax to SARS we've got to pay you, because we've added so many jobs and local content making our C-class that we're exporting, we'll get a rebate. We don't have to pay you so much tax for importing. And that's essentially the administration of that. That's what ITAC does. So the figures that we got from ITAC is just the amount of rebates that they've been issuing. And that's the numbers. It's the administrative function that ITAC has been doing. It's the calculation. But it's essentially the scheme that DTI has worked out to make sure that we're growing the industry, and they've given you those very successful figures. If we go to the next slide, you'll see that ITAC has also been implementing a range of, I'm going to talk about the decreases of tariffs first, to help assist the industry grow. So the first rationale is that ITAC, on a case-by-case basis, has decreased tariffs in the auto industry, where they've received an application to reduce the tariff, and where, for example, the tariff can be reduced because nobody is making those specific products in the country. There's no competition in the country, so you're not wiping out an industry, you're not wiping out any component manufacturers in the country, you're not destroying any small industries or big component industries, you're not reducing employment, you're not reducing the chance of that industry growing in the country. And then, by reducing that tariff, it makes it easier for the OEMs, or the OEMs are the car manufacturers, to be able to have cheaper inputs to make the cars more cheaply and for the industry to grow. So we've got some examples. In the year 2010-2011, ITAC reduced the customs duty on pistons for motor vehicle engines from 20% to free of duty. So it means that the car manufacturers, instead of paying 20% duty when they were importing pistons, they could then import the pistons without paying the customs duty. 2012-2013, ITAC was able to reduce the customs duty on hydraulic brake fluid from 10% to free of duty. And in 2013-2014, ITAC reduced the customs duty on CV joints from 20% to free of duty. Now, sometimes ITAC will get applications where there's a need to reduce the duty, but they won't reduce the tariff to zero. Sometimes they'll just say, we're going to amend the rebate, or we're going to introduce a rebate, because there may be a manufacturer to support, or a rebate will be introduced on a case-by-case basis. So in those cases, the examples there where rebates have been introduced, and a rebate is really a more careful measure that's been introduced to protect the industry. So for example, in 2010-2011, ITAC finalized a rebate for duty on insulated electrical cables used for the manufacture of automotive wiring harnesses, and then ITAC will administer the rebate. And in 2012-2013, ICAC finalized the creation of the rebate 317.03, where the APDP automotive manufacturers have to register in order to benefit from the APDP program. So ICAC administers the program through the rebate. Now, I hate to say, and I'm terribly sorry, I don't know what happened. There was a slide, and it's just somehow disappeared. But I'll speak to it, and if you allow, I'll send it through afterwards. But there are two examples, honourable members, where ICAC has actually increased customs duties, and I'll just explain those to you. So, for example, in 2012-2013, ICAC actually increased the tariffs on laminated safety glass, which is windshields, and the tariffs increased from 15% to 30%. And in that case, the companies that make laminated safety glass, so it would be, for example, and I'm not saying this is a company, but like the PGs or, you know, the companies that make safety glass, would have applied and said, there's glass coming in from overseas. It's coming in much more cheaply than we're able to make it. We need protection for the survival of the company in order to keep investing and in order for us to protect jobs. And please can you make the rebate? And ICAC, on the basis of an examination, would have then raised the tariff. So in that case, ICAC raised the tariff. And in 2014, ICAC raised the tariff on auto batteries from 5% to 15%. So in fact, you can see, I mean, there are varied actions that they take in the auto industry, from reducing the tariffs to introducing rebates or amending rebates, to in fact sometimes raising tariffs. It really depends what's happening on a case-by-case basis. The other thing that ICAC has been doing is ICAC administers import and export control. So in fact, most importantly, ICAC issues import licenses, specifically on used vehicles. Because used vehicles come into the country significantly more cheaply than new vehicles, but an inflow of cheaper used vehicles poses a direct threat to our auto industry and our auto industry growing and investing. So ICAC has got quite strict rules about when one is allowed to import a used vehicle. You've got to get an import permit from ICAC before you're allowed to import. And these are some of the rules. If you're immigrating into South Africa or if you're returning to South Africa from working abroad, you are allowed to bring your personal vehicle to South Africa, but then you've got to prove, for example, that you're coming back to South Africa from working abroad, you are a South African resident, you're bringing your car back, so you've got to prove all of that before ICAC will allow you to bring your car back. If, for example, you're physically disabled and you need a specially customized car and you want to bring in a second-hand car from overseas and the second-hand car has got specifically what you need, you can bring it, but then you've also got to prove that it's a second-hand car, it's got what you need because you're physically disabled. You can bring in vintage cars, but it's got to be older than 40 years old and you've got to show that you're bringing in it for yourself. And you are allowed to bring in a racing car, which I thought was quite interesting, but you've got to be a licensed racing driver as well. And that can be a second-hand car. What you can also do is you can bring in specially designated vehicles. So, for example, it can be a mobile crane, and, you can bring in vehicles specially for agriculture or taxis, components. So, I mean, there is allowance for special use. But then there are also restrictions. So, for example, it's not allowed to be made in South Africa. So it's making sure that our local industry is still protected to a large degree. And then ICAC also enforces the import control. So they'll go, for example, on scheduled and unscheduled visits to the site to make sure that the licenses are being enforced. The Competition Commission has been quite active, and there are two areas that specifically have been relating to components. The first area points to, in fact, widespread collusion. They've received information on widespread collusion by manufacturers of automotive components. So specifically, they're in the process of launching an investigation around automotive components subject to collusion, and they're doing that with the evidence that they've already got in their possession. The information indicates that 121 automotive components have been subject to collusion. The Commission's already launched an investigation in respect of 85 components, and it's finalising investigations into the outstanding components. So you'll see quite a lot of activity going forward in terms of automotive components. The second area where the Commission has been active is in relation to panel beaters. And two firms have specifically been in the spotlight. That's Precision and Sons and Eldon Auto Bodies, where those two firms have colluded on auto body repairs or panel beating work. And specifically, they were getting quotes from panel beaters, well, insurance companies. They were colluding around those quotes. So work has been done. Those firms were raided. Information was gathered from them. And the investigation was finalised, and it's been referred to the tribunal. In fact, it was, well, at the end of last month, it was just referred. So the tribunal will be taking up the matter. So that's the work that's been undertaken by the agencies that we have oversight over. And as always, we welcome your insights, we welcome your questions, and we welcome to hear from you.
Thank you very much, Acting PDG. Can we then go for tea break for 10 minutes and then come back? Thank you.
I think that's probably
Somebody close the door for us, please. Members, let us start our discussion. Mr. Mare.
Thank you very much, Chair. Just to the economic development, they preempted my question on the jobs, so I got my answer in terms of saves the new jobs, so thank you very much for that one. The second one was on the 25% duties on the fully built up vehicles. As I've indicated, I know about the importation of vehicles for people with disabilities under the IDEC permit. And the amount that was paid back was certainly not 25%. A couple of years ago it was 25%, but as far as my knowledge is, that's been reduced to about 18%. So I'd just like to get the correct amount on that, so that also impacts on the figures in terms of the rebates. My following one is the that next one in terms of the rebate credits. These are based on the local value additions. Now, I've posed this question in the past of what is local value. And I've used the example where we as a portfolio committee, at that stage it was DTI where I served, we went to, let's call it Volkswagen, and we went to a component manufacturer, basically next door, where they do the roof linings and the door linings. Now that was 100% South African produced product. Really fully automated plant. All the blow molders was imported. All the raw material was imported. But it was locally, it was 100% locally produced South African product, which is an insult in my opinion. Because there was nothing coming from South Africa. Nothing. So in my opinion, that is wrong. It means that, you know, we live in a fool's paradise if we see that as a 100% locally produced product in terms of value added. There is no local value being added. There's so few jobs in that plant that we haven't even created substantial jobs. So to use that as a full credit, and that is my question on that one. Whether that is, you know, what is its local value and how would that be determined? And then also on the next page where we talk about the tariffs, I sometimes get the impression that we use tariffs predominantly as a punitive action. Now, in the cases where it's been reduced to the duty to zero, when I ask the question, in place of that duties, should we not look at Because remember, when you reduce duties, it's an impact on the cost of the locally produced vehicle then. But it's predominantly foreign companies that you put a tariff on for imports. But what are the rewards on the flip side to South African companies? So you know, my question is, have we considered rather rewarding local producers in terms of local content as well, rather than put a tariff on foreign products being imported? Because, you know, and one asked the question, where do you get the most benefit, local economic benefit, development benefit? By rewarding local people in an incentive to actually create more jobs, or by putting a punitive action on foreign components or products being imported? On the Competition Commission's role, based on the example that I've used of the what I determine as not a 100% locally produced product or a component, I'm very certainly interested in getting more information with regards to those collusion between manufacturers and components, because I mean, I'm immediately said to myself, that example that I've used, is that probably one of those examples of collusion? And whether you can give us more information, like you've given us on the panel beaters, can we get the real cases on that one? Now, Chairperson, I've got questions for the DTI as well, but that depends on you, whether you want me to ask them as well, or that we first get a first round.
You can go ahead.
Okay, thank you very much. On the Mr. Chair, I'm going to stand down for the moment. I'll rather come in later.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Mr. Atkinson.
Thank you very much, Chair. And it's a question to both the DTI and the Economic Development Department. I would just like to know what the effect of load shedding has been on motor car manufacture in South Africa. When one looks at, I mean, we've been to the production line of BMW, and we see how incredibly automated that is and how they have a requirement to produce a certain amount of cars every day for export and everything. So are they just not being load shedded, or is there some way that you've worked in to sort it out? But I'm just wondering what effect it is having on the manufacture of cars. The second question is with regards to jobs and the quality of jobs, because I think what we're seeing now, and certainly in the manufacture of cars, is we've seen greater skill being required, people really becoming machine operators rather than actual assemblers of cars. So I'm just wondering, within those job stats, is there an increase in quality of jobs? Have the skills required increased? Or are we seeing less jobs on the assembly line now and more requirements for machine operators or whatever? And then the third question was, in the second presentation, we spoke about the role of ITAC and the rebate credits. It was just interesting that the rebate credits, obviously 2009, 2010, were 2.8 billion, and then they increased 10 times to 21, 27, 25, 34, and then dropped again quite significantly to 9.2. I was just wondering what the reason for that alteration in the rebate credits were. Thank you.
Thanks. Honourable Diana.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I'll be very happy if both the DTI and the EDD could respond to my question, overarching question, not necessarily based on the presentation per se. You see, these companies, those from Germany, Japan, and so on, Britain, they've been doing business here from the early 90s. Now we're in 2015. we have the Competitions Commission here, is trying to ensure that, you know, there is adequate competition there. But what kind of competition are we referring to if these are essentially companies from abroad in any case? But my understanding is that if we had our own cars, or at least our car as South Africans, would then speak of a tangible competition. But now the competition that we are looking at is the one between BMW and Mercedes and so on and so on. Well, they create jobs for us, that we accept. But what is it that we need to do as a country, as a nation, to be able to produce our own cars? We can assemble as much as we like, but we assemble something that does not belong to us in any case. What is our vision? Do we want to continue assembling, etc., etc.? There are countries in Asia who are beginning to produce their own cars now, in Asia, of all people. I just want to get a sense from the leadership here, because, you know, they understand the industry much, much better than us. Looking ahead, not just looking at the figures today, we've created 1,000 jobs here, we've done this. Looking ahead, because, you know, right now there are all these tensions that are going on between the U.S., Russia, and so on, BRICS. All these things, they affect us. What is it that we need to do to be able to say, here is our baby, we've produced our car now. We're the biggest economy in Africa. Don't be fooled by what you are told about Nigeria and all that. We are indeed the biggest economy on the continent. That is my question. I hope it makes sense, because, you know, it does not necessarily relate per se to the presentation, I think.
Thanks, Honorable John.
Thank you very much. I think mine is more like the DTI, but it's to DTI. It's on the policy issue. I wanted to ask the same thing, but mine is on localization. Remember, we had good doctors from Cuba. We brought them here. We even took a South African to study medicine in Cuba. Now, I wanted to check, policy-wise, how can we get our people to learn to manufacture, to localize everything? Everything should be produced in South Africa. What does it say about the selling rights, the right to that brand, like it's from Germany, then we want to bring it to South Africa, making it our own? I think that Etian has explained it more easily in saying, what is it that we need to do to have our own car? Because the whole tension is not our own product, but now we want to look at the policy. What says the policy in terms of us having those rights that are being in South Africa, producing everything in South Africa? Thank you.
Mr. Murray.
Chairperson, thank you very much. The one question is probably going to help you to answer those questions. So I want to know about the dual electric car. We know that through the DTI and EDD, IDC has invested millions of rand in this. Okay, whatever the question, but I know that DTI is I think, is Shell in the company who has developed. Okay. But at least that we get the information on the dual, because a couple of years ago, a big hype was made of this electric South African car, 100%, you know, South African product. And I know that there are reasons, competition, etc., why that is on hold at the moment. So if you can give us progress and what you expect from there. Then the other question is on the APDP. We have seen the rebates, and I've asked myself many times the question. The APD is costing us money, firstly through the incentives, and the rebate stuff that is paid, but there are also another cost attached to that. That obviously increases the profitability of those companies, and we know that it is foreign-owned companies, so the dividends flow out of South Africa. That is an indirect cost to South African economy. If you look at the benefits, have you done that calculation to compare the direct cost and indirect cost of the APDP with the benefits that we're getting, and tangible benefits, just to see whether this is very lucrative or how lucrative this program and the related aspects of that component of that program is. Thank you very much.
Can we get responses?
Chair, thank you very much to honourable members. And maybe just to kick off on some of the big things, and Mkululi will come in on some of the technical issues and the detail. And I think the honourable member is asking the right question in a way. Should we produce our own car? The answer to the question is yes, if we had the money. And we're talking not tens of billions, we're talking hundreds and hundreds of billions to design, develop, commercialize, market, technology, innovation, and so on. So they are successful national manufacturers. Thailand, for example, doesn't have its own car. In Thailand, to import a foreign manufactured vehicle, you pay an 80% tariff compared to South Africa's 25%. Most of the cars you see in Thailand are made in Thailand, and they are mainly Toyota, Honda, and Mitsubishi. Thailand has become a production hub in the Southeast Asia for export into Australia, Indonesia, Malaysia, Vietnam, and so on and so forth. So, and by the way, Thailand has reduced its unemployment to something like 5%. They don't have any resources apart from agricultural resources and tourist resources. They have a laser-focused industrial strategy which focuses on autos in particular, but other sectors as well, electrotechnical, agro-processing, and so on and so forth. So it is a, if you can afford your own vehicle, then that is a very good thing. But if you can't, which I don't think we can, leave aside all the enormous complexities of developing your own vehicle, it is not necessarily the case that you can't build your country into an automotive production hub. The key thing about Thailand, to some extent Morocco, to some extent Mexico, none of whom have their own vehicles, is to increase localization and to design your policy instruments to support localization in some of those countries on a narrower range of models or types of cars that you make, and to combine demand from your domestic markets with your with exports, which require greater levels of economies of scale, higher technology absorption, raising competitiveness in the supply chains, and especially ensuring that your policy instruments support localization, which the APDP tries to do, Chairperson, and which we are obviously trying to increase as we speak. The DTI recently commissioned a study by the Nobel Economics Professor Stiglitz to look at some of these issues. And to answer the Honourable Member's question, which is a really important question, how do we learn to manufacture as a country? And the ARPA 2015 points very specifically to that question. With due respect, my colleague Mkululi or myself or Tanya, we don't have the skills to be able to, you know, teach somebody who's making a carburetor in a supply chain how to make that carburetor. It's a global automotive equipment manufacturer in this space, or in the rail space, General Electric or China South Railway, that can ensure that in the supply chains, those supply companies are supported to be able to manufacture, to use your words. In other words, to provide products, either as first, second, or third tier suppliers, to the required standard and specification, on time, at the right price, which meets the requirements, whether it's a Ford or a Mercedes-Benz, so that that supplier can develop and produce that product and supply it to Ford Motor Company anywhere in the world. In other words, the supply chains of original equipment manufacturers are critical to industrialization effort. In other words, these huge global companies are absolutely critical to our industrial development, whether they are in South Africa, whether they are in the automotive sector, or Samsung that has just come into the Dubai Trade Port, or the renewable energy component manufacturers. So the critical question then is, to learn to manufacture, government has to develop a close working relationship with these original equipment manufacturers and design a set of policy instruments which support them and at the same time support localization. That essentially is one route to, and perhaps the most important route to, learning to manufacture as a country, which is raising technology and technology absorption, innovation, learning by doing with the support of government, including, by the way, in the supply chains, to ensure that greater levels of transformation and black economic empowerment are achieved. I'm just trying to answer the big question that's been asked, and perhaps my colleague in Kululi can deal with some of the specific questions.
Thank you. Through you, Chair, let me try to answer a number of these questions. Firstly, the import duties. The import duty for light motor vehicles is 25%. However, as part of the arrangement we have with the European Union, we're giving their imports a preference of 7%, which means, therefore, if you import your vehicle from Europe, what is due as
duty is 18%.
In calculating local value addition, you take out all the imported value. You consider only the local cost. So if you sell your components to a vehicle assembler at 100 and the cost of your raw materials that you imported was a 50, you need to subtract that 50 from the final calculation for local value add. Local value add, of course, will include your markup, unfortunately, and any other manufacturing cost that you have. But you take out all imported content in that part. In some instances, you find that there are subcomponents that are imported and more values added into a sub-assembly. So you eliminate all that. And also in terms of your basic raw material, you also eliminate that. You're looking at automotive specific value addition. What it means simply is that if you were to make a widget from a locally mined coal, only the value addition on that coal rather than the value of the coal itself qualifies for this support. So we're trying to limit it to local value addition in the automotive supply chain. However, it is true that especially at the first tier level, you find increasing automation. Hence, if you look at the figures, although the different companies would have a different labor capital mix, but by and large, you see that they employ about 30,000 people, 7 OEMs or vehicle assemblers, but the supply network employs more than double that amount because there's more labor created at the. But, of course, in terms of the quality of the employment created by the vehicle assemblers is generally higher than the supply chain. And, of course, with the first-tier suppliers, also they require higher skill levels, and also the remuneration would be definitely higher for such. On tariffs, vis-a-vis rewards of local production. In the main, what you will find from ITAX considerations to increase or decrease tariffs, firstly would be whether we have capacity. We have somebody manufacturing that particular widget or product in South Africa, because that tariff that's there would be protection to that local manufacturer. But in some cases you find that we don't have that capacity, whether it's capacity that we had in the past or we simply didn't have that capacity. So all those considerations would be taken into the mix in considering whether to increase or decrease a tariff. So in itself, it is a reward for local manufacturing. But in instances where it's seen to be ineffective or eroded, hence you would find that there would be those applications coming and the full-on study is made before a final decision is made. Load shedding. Load shedding has had an indirect and direct impact, negative impact on vehicle assembly. While whilst your vehicle assemblers would have had some form of backups that they've since installed, but for the component manufacturers, not all of them can afford such investments. And not only load shedding, but the reliability of the supply of energy itself. In some instances, you find that due to maintenance issues, perhaps some areas are cut off the grid for a number of days, and that affects their supply because they have to supply to the vehicle assemblers just on time. So there is that direct to the suppliers and indirect impact. However, it has then encouraged some of them to invest in some form of backup. Some vehicle assemblers have managed to strike some form of deals with the local authorities or whoever supplies them directly. And in some instances, they are considering alternative sources of energy. During the State of the City address in Tshwane, the mayor announced their partnership with BMW, for instance, in generating energy, bioenergy. So there are such initiatives. Yes, at the moment, it's not that huge to supply their entire operation, but it's a significant, I mean, it's a step in the right direction in considering using waste to also generate energy that they can also supply back to the grid in some instances where they don't require it. Coming back to Tanya's figures, perhaps one other indication, I'm just worried, I'm not sure if there will be another explanation, is that let's look at the rebate certificate that you get after all the calculations that you get from ITAC. In fact, ITAC sends that to SAS. It will have a face value saying the local value addition year was 100. So the face value of that rebate certificate will be 100. It means that you can then import, if it was end on component exports, for instance, it means you can import a qualifying automotive component with a value of 100 without paying the duty, whatever the duty was. So if you are importing from the EU, the duty will be 18%. It means you submit a certificate with a face value of 100 and you don't pay that 18%. If you're importing elsewhere where the duty is higher, maybe tires, it means your benefits, your real benefits changes. But the face value of that certificate. So in sometimes in calculating and getting these figures from ITAC, one has to have a sense on whether what they're providing is the face value of the certificate or a calculation on what duty would have been foregone, which means for components would be the 20% if they're coming from elsewhere other than the EU. And the same for vehicles. So we'll just need to make sure that those figures are correctly reflected, because I don't see how it would have had such a serious spike. The Joule. A group of scientists came together and were assisted by the Department of Science and Technology through their agencies to work on designing an electric vehicle. When they managed to put together a vehicle which they thought it was ready to be taken to market, the IDC got involved took some shareholding in the company, and GTI started getting interested and indicated that if this comes through as a vehicle production plant, we would provide support through the available mechanisms like your automotive investment scheme and so on. However, they were at the stage where they had to now come up with a working business plan, which I'm told, as it was interrogated, there were a few holes that were found, hence it never went to the commercialization stage. And therefore, the DST has taken whatever remains of the assets of that company to the Nelson Mandela Metropolitan University for use in further research and development work on electric vehicles and similar technologies. So whatever was left will be found in the Nelson Mandela Bay or Port Elizabeth, which is used at the academic level at this stage. When we came up with the APDP in 2008, there was a work that we did with the assistance of the IDC, looking into the proposals that were coming through from that review, which indicated that by and large the benefits of supporting the automotive industry outweighed the cost of doing so. However, I think it's something that as we look beyond the APDP in the very near future, we should also do such studies or evaluations again. So what came out was that by and large the benefits for the country outweighed any costs involved. I think I'm done.
Thank you. Person, maybe on the skills issue, the automotive sector is in the economic theory and literature regarded as a very high spillover sector. In other words, there are very high economic multipliers, that's upstream. All the supply companies, the component manufacturer, the steel producers, the plastics and composite producers, the leather producers, all the upstream inputs are very critical. Then there's all the downstream, which is everything from logistics, rail, transport, ports, exports, retail, services, and so on and so forth. So it's got very high economic multipliers. It's also got very high spillovers in terms of skills, because the skills required to be able to assemble a vehicle and the assembly lines, as you would have seen when you visited, I think you said, Volkswagen, are very high, but the skills required in the component manufacturer are very high and increasingly higher with automation. And the job intensity in the supply companies is much higher than in the assembly, which is why it's very important to support stronger localization, because that's where there's much higher employment multipliers and intensity. I think the explanation that Mkululi's given about the jewel is also an important explanation, because as a country we should probably be cautious of big bang new grand ideas, and the examples where we spent a lot of money, the jewel is one of them, the pebble-bed nuclear reactor is probably another example, when in fact developing countries like our own middle income countries, gradual improvements in technology absorption are absolutely critical to the industrialization effort. And high risk, big projects of this kind, of course, which can change the landscape if you get them right. So in the history of South Africa's industrialization, government support under the apartheid government for Sasol was a game changer, because it was massive government support for a particular technology with huge volumes of money spent on research and development, which could then be commercialized. But it carries high risk, and so we are trying to work very closely with the Department of Science and Technology to ensure that in each sector there are roadmaps for technology, which is both innovation and obviously innovation and our own research and development is important, but at the same time, equally and perhaps even more important, is technology absorption and OEMs that operate in South Africa are one of the means for technology absorption, because don't forget, if OEM X wins a contract to supply X model from the mother company sitting in the US or in Germany, they have to make that model to the required global standards, so that they have to ensure that there's technology transfer and technology absorption, both in the assembly and the production plant, as well as in the suppliers to that particular model, whatever it might be. So the jewel is perhaps an interesting example of high-risk innovation, which goes wrong, as opposed to gradual improvement and technology absorption, which perhaps in many ways is much more important to the industrial effort. Thank you.
Can I allow China to say something, and then we go to Honorable Mbata?
And I won't be too long. On the quality of jobs, because we're talking quite a bit about that, I agree with everything that's been said. Just to add a few things, generally the jobs in the automotive sector, certainly in the OEMs and in the component manufacturers, but not going down into the petrol stations, but generally those jobs are better paid. So when I've been in factories, for example, in the Eastern Cape, in the auto plant, people there speak about, you know, needing highly skilled workers. When I've been in other factories in the Eastern Cape, they speak about problems retaining skilled workers, because the skilled workers want to go into the OEMs or want to go into the auto sector because those jobs are better paid. The other thing is what I found, and you know, I'd be curious to hear what other people's experiences are, is that because the OEMs work so closely in terms of supplier developments with a component manufacturer, it's not only in terms of making sure the design is right and supply to the, you know, like the BMWs and the Volkswagens is correct, but also making sure that the people producing the components are actually able to produce the components correctly. So there's a huge amount of work and effort making sure that skills and training takes place for workers working in those areas. And then once you've got really skilled workers working there, the benefits and conditions are commensurate to ensure that retention takes place. I mean, the discussion on the Competition Commission is really interesting and what kind of car do we want. But what I think the Competition Commission is doing as well, certainly in the investigations that I alerted the Portfolio Committee to, is to say that when it's looking at components, there needs to be a sufficient level of competition between the components, the auto component manufacturers, to make sure that the inputs of components to the OEMs, the big vehicle manufacturers, there's a sufficient level of competition to make sure that those prices are right. But on the second level, it's not only to make sure that the components are right for those big overseas companies that the honourable member is referring to, but to have competition among auto component manufacturers is really important as well, because it means that smaller auto component manufacturers who want to come in can also break into the market as well, if there's a sufficient level of competition between the auto component manufacturers. Another thing is that the auto components are not just purchased by the OEMs, but it's also there's a very important after-sales market. And the after-sales market is not just for, you know, people servicing big cars in the Mercedes and the VWs and the BMWs, but it's just ordinary everyday people who need very affordable parts, buying a part who they may be fitting the part themselves, they may be fitting a part in an ordinary garage down the road. So the Competition Commission is making sure that ordinary parts are very affordable for everyday people who need to buy parts, and ordinary people in the street can keep, where they do own cars, can keep cars running, or for taxis and public transport, so that's vehicles are affordable for everyday people and working class people as well. The second thing is for the car insurance industry and the panel beaters. So on the one hand, you know, big rich people who can afford insurance on luxury vehicles may have their insurance inflated, and the insurance companies may be raising premiums for affluent people, and that's, you know, that raises prices for everybody. But on the other hand, a lot of middle-class people, which would be honourable members, but it also would be teachers, nurses, policemen, policewomen, you know, and going down the ranks to less well-paid people, working people, who could afford a car, maybe battling to pay to afford a car. It means that car insurance would be rising for everybody, and maybe people who can't afford car insurance as well, but want to try and fix a car, and that, you know, people who don't use public transport but are just struggling to maybe get to a panel beater, it just helps make sure that those kind of abuses in the market aren't taking place as well. So I take your point 100% about what should we be doing to ensure that we look at how we get a South African car. In terms of what the Competition Commission is doing as well, it's doing a range of investigations to ensure that competition is helping entry for a variety of businesses in terms of growth and promotion of business into the auto component sector, and then also ensuring that where people do have access to a car, be it middle class people, wealthier people, or people who are just fortunate enough to have access to a car at all, are able to afford some kind of components. And then, of course, it would be protecting jobs in the industry. The other thing in terms of tariffs, I mean, the issue on tariffs has been discussed as well. I just wanted to raise one thing, you know, whether tariffs punitive or not. But our tax mandate really is to ensure that there is fair trade. So I don't want to belabor the point at all, but in terms of ensuring fair trade, it does look at whether there's a level playing field. to some extent. So it would look at price disadvantage to some extent, and it would be done in conjunction, not in conjunction, but I mean it's really one of a number of industrial policy instruments. So in autos, I mean, we've looked at the other industrial policy instruments, and tariffs would be one saying, is there price disadvantage, and does the industry need support? The other things which we haven't looked at here, and in fact there aren't, but would be to say, where do you remedy for unfair trade? And there isn't really unfair trade here because there are no anti-dumping duties for cars or auto components here. But if there were, ARTEC would be remedying for that. I just forget. May I add one thing? The request for more information on what the Competition Commission is doing in terms of the cases we'll happily bring to Portfolio Committee members. They're just doing the investigation now. As soon as they've got more on investigations, and I'll ask them when they have, because the names that we've got there are public now, as soon as the other stuff, the investigation is at a point where we can bring to members, we'll happily bring it to members in as much detail as we can, only with pleasure.
Thanks. Honourable Mbata.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. My question is directed at both the DTI and the economic development. I just need to know, for instance, with the majority of the car manufacturers, in particular those that are doing it inside the territory, starting using platinum, what has been the escalating contribution to that, to the economy within the automotive sector? The fact that it's done and we are the main producer in the world, but most importantly also, what has been the spin-off delivered by that eventuality to the South African consumer? The fact that you are no longer getting that elsewhere, you are getting it internally, there should be some extraordinary value add, and that should be passed over to the consumer. And maybe as a side concern, I find it extremely difficult to be a South African or South African in these days. For instance, the GTR, the most popular medium-sized car for young yuppie kids in UK, it's bought as a present for 21st and 18-year birthdays. And here in this country, that's a car for a middle-income person. And it's made up on almost everything is made here. Yet our own people who work, they cannot afford it. It's afforded for kids in UK. I mean, what does this say to our growing middle class? It means they will always chase in the dream, even when things are done in our own country.
Thanks, Honourable Mbata. Any follow-ups or new questions or contributions? Honourable.
I know this question is not directly related to motor car manufacturing, but it is related to the motor car industry. It was of interest to me about a year and a half ago to go to the Northern Cape and to see how many companies from, how many of the big motor car manufacturers actually use the Northern Cape as testing grounds for their cars. And there seems to be a whole industry up there with Audi and Porsche and Volkswagen and you name it. I mean, just about everyone's there, and they bring their cars and fly them into Upington and they test their cars in the Northern Cape. And to my mind, it must be a fairly significant contributor to the economy of the Northern Cape. I was just wondering if any investigation has been done as to what the contribution to the economy of the Northern Cape, how that's quantified, through obviously the testing of cars. I was just wondering if you've got any comments on that. Thank you.
Thanks. Can I then ask some questions? Honourable Tiani.
Thank you, Chair. Just a small follow-up question. Thank you very much for all your explanations. You know, they make us wiser. they allow us to understand just a little bit more about the ramifications and all the dynamics that are involved in the system. But you indicated that even if we don't produce our own car to sell, we can get on the bandwagon, but do it very smartly and be focused and reduce the range of the issues that we engage in. For instance, if we target a Toyota car, maybe two or three models we focus there. This is what we produce in South Africa. And we get all the expertise and so on. Presently, coming from the DTI, do you get the sense that we are already beginning to move in that direction? Or do you think that our plate is still cluttered and so on? Thank you.
Thanks, Anusian. I just want to ask the meaning of OEM. MIDP, APDP, and PAA. Then there's a question that is directed to DTI regarding the duty loss versus tax benefit. What does it mean for SACU revenue? Another one directed to EDD regarding the ITC investment. Where is ITC investment? Is it in retail or deal or component manufacturing? Another one is on ITEC rebate credit. How do you explain the fluctuation? What is the usage? Can the certificate be transferable or sold? Yeah.
Maybe just through you, Honourable Chair, to kick off, we'd have to get the data on vehicle sales in the UK, so I don't have those at the tip of my fingers, but I'm not sure that I would agree with your analysis. In fact, inequality in a country like the UK has increased. It hasn't diminished. Maybe the upper classes give GTIs to their children, but we would be happy to give you the exact data on vehicle sales in a country like the UK, as well as volume per model, something like a GTI. And if we can get it, the extent to which a vehicle like this is purchased by the middle class. But to answer the question specifically on platinum, the catalytic converter companies in South Africa do receive a benefit under the APDP. And those benefits have allowed investment in catalytic converter manufacture. Catalytic converters are not enormously value-adding components. They're not like an engine or a carburetor or a drivetrain or anything like that. They're essentially emissions controlling devices. The amount of platinum used in them is actually rather small. Catalytic converter companies operating in South Africa do not get a comparative advantage other than the incentive supplied to them by the APDP. In other words, they don't get cheaper platinum. And I would suggest that our catalytic converter industry, were we to withdraw the incentive in the absence of a cheaper platinum price, we would likely lose the catalytic converter industry to other jurisdictions which have higher, lower input costs, including electricity, not only the supply constraints, but the price of electricity, and as we know, the premium added by municipalities is often very high, especially in the Eastern Cape. And this is precisely why the DCR, working with the DST, is trying to, and working with the mining companies, is trying to raise demand for platinum. And the biggest opportunity to raise demand for platinum is static fuel cell energy generation. The technology does not at the moment allow for mobile fuel cell technology power generation, but as you may have seen at the Chamber of Mines and in two other localities supported by the DTI, there are now pilot plants for fuel cell static power generation. This represents a very significant opportunity for South Africa, which is why the possibility exists for designating a special economic zone for fuel cell technology. It is why we are working very closely with the Department of Science and Technology, the CSIR, and global companies that own the intellectual property for fuel cell technology to perhaps generate or enable the development of a new industry. MTN and I think Vodacom are already rolling out transmitters and relay stations which are powered by fuel cell technology plants, and the possibility exists of that extending into Africa. So I'm making this point, Chairperson, because if we see catalytic converters as the and the jewelry industry, where we are also doing very significant pieces of work on platinum, but if we see the catalytic converter demand as the only source of platinum demand in circumstances where platinum is recyclable, when a catalytic converter reaches the end of its life, the platinum is recycled, then, you know, we are we would be making a very big mistake. In response to the Honourable Member's question, I think we should recognise the fact that perhaps the biggest constraint is the fact that we've got a very small market, domestic market. So a successful auto manufacturer like Mexico, notwithstanding their problems, exports on their doorstep into the biggest markets in the world. Thailand exports into this huge expanding Southeast Asia market. We don't have that market, but as Mkululi showed in the slide, the possibility now exists, and we are working very closely with the Nigerian government to explore industrial relationships and partnerships with a country like Nigeria that is just starting automotive assembly, moving to production and component suppliers, that we build that relationship and explore the possibilities of complementarities between a country like Nigeria and ourselves, where you could then have what you are referring to is, for example, the division who's been to Musina will see that there is football fields of second-hand Hondas waiting to go into Zimbabwe. On the one hand, that has a positive benefit for the citizens of those countries because they are able to import a nearly new vehicle. On the other hand, as I think Mkululi hinted at, if you don't have policy coherence in these countries, you won't be able to start local manufacture or even local assembly because you are importing second-hand vehicles. Perhaps the irony is that some of these jurisdictions which export second-hand vehicles into Africa have a incentive regime which allows citizen X to sell his car and get a rebate if the car is, I think it's under 25,000 kilometers, and very often that vehicle is then exported into Africa. So there are complex problems of alignment of industrial policy, and I thought the point that Tanya made was important. Industrial policy is a complex set of interlocking policy measures, incentives, tariffs, and all those other things. And so the best opportunity for us exists in the probability that a free trade area in Africa comes about beyond the existing free trade area, and that the market for vehicles manufactured in South Africa increases dramatically, but that we need to also be very sensitive to the fact that we can't just be seen as a country which is exporting into our neighbors, and that we need to build regional industrial integration in value chains, which is precisely why the Department of Trade and Industry recently has created a new institutional architecture, both a division responsible for exports and investment into Africa, a new division, but also falling under industrial development, a chief directorate responsible for regional industrial integration. And that would apply to significant opportunities in automotives, in mining and mining capital equipment, in pharmaceuticals and chemicals. It's the value chains that we are starting this work in. I hope that perhaps Mkululi could answer the question on the SACU revenue basket, as well as the acronyms which we've been using.
Thanks. So, on the acronyms, in the context of automotive, OEMs, which are original equipment manufacturers, are used to refer to your vehicle assemblers, the likes of Volkswagen, Ford, and so on. In 1995, we created a policy called the MIDP, which is short for the Motor Industry Development Program, which came into operation in September 1995. And in 2013, we implemented in full the APDP, which is the Automotive Production and Development Program, which is the support scheme with four elements I spoke about earlier. The difference between the MIDP and the APDP can also be found in one of the elements. They both have four key elements: tariffs, duty-free allowance, the rebate earnings,
but the difference is on the form of investment support. Under the MIDP, you had the productive asset allowance, which was also in the form of a duty credit that was earned as a percentage of qualifying investments. So the PAA would be productive asset allowance, whereas under the APDP, you have the cash grant available under the Automotive Investment Scheme, the AIS. Because this is based on duty rebates and therefore under the Customs Act, this also applies to SACU. In terms of the revenue, yes, it does impact on that, decreases that because you can rebate your duties. But let's also understand that in putting the MIDP and therefore the APDP together, the components for vehicle assembly were organized in a special chapter, Chapter 98, and the duty thereon is pegged at 20%. Whereas you can import those various components through individual lines if you are an individual or you're not in vehicle assembly, and the duties there would vary from zero to the highest being tires per 30%. But for ease of administration and also to create a duty pool that could be rebated, there was this special creation of a Chapter 98. And because also the MIDP and the APDP applies SACU-wide, it provided an opportunity for some manufacturing of automotive components in these jurisdictions. Of course, we put South Africa first, but if our neighbors benefit, that's okay. At the moment, you have a harness manufacturer based in Gaborone, Botswana. You also have a leather interior company that's moved to Maseru in Lesotho. And they get all the benefits under the APDP in terms of the value addition, except for the Automotive Investment Scheme, which is on budget. So they do benefit in that way. As to the Northern Cape contribution of the research work, we'll have to find if there's any specific study that's been done recently on the benefits. But yes, increasingly that area is being utilized for testing vehicles because of its conditions. But it's something that we can look into. Thank you. Perhaps to future on affordability of vehicles. That is a complex issue, but perhaps briefly, you would find that South Africa has oil refineries to make our own petrol, which is sold locally, but you find that from the same refinery there's petrol or gasoline that's sold in our neighboring countries at different prices. So what goes into the pricing? There's a lot of other costs besides your simple production costs that get factored into such production. From your taxes and duties, a variety of them, and in some jurisdictions, some discounts that can be offered. So you'll find that, yes, the car might be built in South Africa with 30-40% local content, because anyway, this, some of the components has been imported and sold elsewhere, but at different prices because of a number of other considerations or factors that get into the pricing. And in South Africa, for instance, your GTI would sell with some components that are not necessarily standard in a GTI sold elsewhere. For instance, the leather seats they might not have leather seats, and in South Africa you might have leather seats but not the seat warmer, which is also costly. So there will be a number of variations that get factored into the final price, but it's a complex area that has attracted some attention in the past. I'm sure there's a literature out there on affordability of vehicles. Thank you.
Honourable Mbatha, a follow-up.
Follow-up, Chair. Thank you very much. I do think, though, that at some point, as DTI, you, in plain clothing language, you need to know exactly how much those input costs drive the cost of the vehicle. I think it's for your own information as a provider of various schemes that support the industry. But be that as it may, Chair, my last follow-up is, I need to know, for instance, what informs all these schemes, whether it is a 20% scheme, whether it belongs to Chapter 98, where is the national interest? What greater a percentage does our national interest get protected, both in terms of what we want to view as our positive attitude to the industry, or as our protective attitude to the industry, in whatever nature? How do we define these things? I'm not getting that coming through, and I fail to understand why Europe will dodge a scheme at X percentage and we do it here at Y percentage. Just enlighten me, what informs our own?
Yeah, I don't think there are any successful industrializing countries anywhere in the world at any time that haven't had an autos industry. It's one of the highest technology mass production with the highest economic and employment multipliers and the highest technology absorption. But you can go another route, and Australia has chosen to go that route. So as I said earlier, they just closed the door on the last auto manufacturer, producer, assembler in Australia. And they've gone that route because they are, like South Africa, a resource-rich country, massive export of resources, mainly to China. And then they've got a very robust agro-processing, tourism, light manufacturing. They've taken a decision to dispense with their auto sector. Is that the right decision? I think this government would argue that it's entirely the wrong decision, that our automotive sector is not only a massive contributor to quality jobs, to exports, to skills, and supporting up and downstream industries, whether it's platinum, steel, plastics, leather, composites, and so on and so forth. If you take the incentives away, rest assured that you are likely to either see the demise of your auto sector, or perhaps even the complete collapse of your auto sector. And so you should measure the incentives, which are both tax expenditure, tax foregone, and on-budget incentives, against the very significant negative impact that that would have on the economy, including in relation to a city like East London, which to some extent doesn't, I suppose rely would be the wrong word, but is very significantly dependent upon the fact that Mercedes-Benz is located in East London. So I think we should be very careful to not see industrial policy in a very narrow way and simply do a mechanical impact assessment which pushes numbers in on one side and comes out with numbers on the other side. As much as it's important to constantly evaluate and review not only the policy instruments but the impact of the policy instruments, which is precisely why even before the end of the APDP we are doing a review of the APDP to see whether we can, in close collaboration with the original equipment manufacturers and the supply companies, see whether we can have a higher impact. And the higher impact is to raise competitiveness and localization, jobs, and transformation, especially in the supply industries, as we've said, to the original equipment manufacturers. At the end of the day, it's about a policy choice. Do you want to support an auto industry with all the spillovers and multipliers that it has, or do you want to put your effort and your finances into supporting another sector? The South African government is unequivocal about the fact that the auto sector is absolutely central to the industrialization effort, which doesn't mean, of course, that as we maintain the diversified manufacturing base in South Africa, that other sectors are unimportant, or that we should not pursue new growth sectors. I gave you an example of one, which is the fuel cell technology. Obviously, the green industries would be another, and so on and so forth. And so, you know, that policy choice, at the end of the day, isn't taken by the three of us sitting here. It's the policy choice which is taken at the level of the executive.
Thanks, Vera. Can you get the closing remarks from Natalia?
Thanks, Chief. If I can make my closing remarks, the answer to your questions, if you don't mind. You had asked about the IDC investments and where the IDC invests. The IDC invests in the OEMs and in the components. So I'll give an example. We had given examples last week when the IDC was here. For example, they'd invested in Ford. So when Ford was in distress as a company that manufactures cars, the IDC had invested in cars in order to, you know, in the car manufacturer itself in order to save those jobs. It also invests in component manufacturers, body manufacturers, and I remember last week we had discussed, for example, the company in Worcester. And I'm sorry the honourable member isn't here when we discussed, I can't remember the company's name, but the plant in Worcester that makes components. So just those are two examples that are off the top of my head. But I know, for example, when I was looking through the sheets of web manufacturers as well, that some of the component manufacturers are owned by youth entrepreneurs as well. And I'm going to say companies all over the country, but I can't say exactly where, but I know when we had looked at the map, that they are in various provinces as well. The other thing around the fluctuations around the credit rebates can be sold once, and the drop from 2013 to 2014 and then 2014 to 2015 is a change in methodology and calculation by RTAC. And if you want me to go into the detail, then I can, but they've confirmed to me that it is a change in calculation and methodology.
Thank you very much. Thanks very much for your positive contributions and engagement, and also the members for questions and contributions. Thanks very much. The meeting stands adjourned.